Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
We're going to continue our series on the parables of Jesus, and so I invite you to turn to Matthew chapter 25. I'll give you just a little bit to turn there. I was reading earlier this week, there was a study, I think if I remember, I was by the Barna Group, and they were studying what it is that people are looking for kind of when they go to church, and how it is they want to feel when they walk away, which I thought that's a little bit of a loaded question when you think about how you want to feel when you walk away. But what came about as a result of the study was most Americans, somewhere around 40%, said that they wanted to make sure that they felt encouraged by the time they left church. Now, I'm not going to poll you today on that. There were other things that people were looking for, but when you say, what was the dominant answer, or what was coming out as like number one on the list, and the answer was encouragement. And it got me thinking, because I've been looking at the parables of Jesus, I was looking at the teachings of Jesus, and I asked this question, would everybody in Jesus' audience have always walked away from Jesus and felt encouraged by the time Jesus was done with them? And I kept reading back through the New Testament and some of his sermons and so forth, and I was like, I got to go with a no. Jesus would have actually failed most of the expectations for what most Americans are looking for when they go to church. Now, all of that kind of leads up to what it is I'm talking about today, because Jesus, you know, gathers this crowd, and in Matthew chapter 25, he actually gives three parables. And in those three parables, they each kind of touch. I'm going to talk you over two of those. We'll focus in on the third one, which, as you can kind of tell by what's up here, we're going to be talking about the sheep and the goats. And the real question that we have today is, are you a sheep or are you a goat? And by goat, I don't mean the greatest of all time. I just mean, are you a goat? And it's not going to look good for you at the end of the day by the time Jesus is done. So this is one of those. I'm just saying on the front end of it, Jesus would fail the Barna test today. He just would. But he communicates to his audience because not because he wants them to walk away necessarily feeling a certain way. Jesus wants his audience walking away more connected to him than before they got there. And what that may mean at times is, frankly, we have to get over ourselves to get to that place. So with that in mind, in Matthew 25, Jesus is telling three parables. Each has the same theme. So that's why I'm going to focus mostly on one of them. The main theme is the sheep and the goats. And he tells these parables right before his crucifixion. Jesus is always kind of leading up to this thing. I'm going to be dying, guys, right? And so he shares these parables leading up to his crucifixion. But of course, he's also always talking about not just about his death, but that he's going to rise and he's going to ascend. And so he's trying to give the disciples a little bit, one, here's what's coming, guys. And he does this so that they're ready. They're prepared as much as you can be, right? It's like when you're dealing with the death of a loved one. You can handle the logistics of it in advance, but usually the emotions of it you deal with when you get there. And he's trying to prepare them for as much as he possibly can in advance, all the while knowing there's some stuff that I just can't quite get you ready for. I can speak to it, but I can't get you ready for it, not fully. So he's trying to give them some encouragement. Hang in there, because here's why. No matter what comes to you, I'm coming back. So there's the encouragement, right? No matter what comes to you, I'm coming back. He's also telling them, not just I'm coming back and hey, be encouraged, but it's I'm coming back, so you better be ready. It's kind of the both. So in the three parables in Matthew 25, let me just talk you over the first one. In the first parable, it's about 10 maidens. These are 10 maidens who are supposed to be a part of a huge wedding party or a huge marriage party. Now back in that day and time, people, this was a throwdown. It wasn't the kind of thing like we do where you have a ceremony on a Saturday and by Saturday evening, everybody's gone home. It didn't work like that back then. These shindigs lasted like a week. Can you imagine that one? This is why the wedding at Cana, which is Jesus' first miracle, this thing's been going on for days. And eventually somebody comes up and says, Jesus, we're running out of wine. We were hoping you could do a trick, right? Because it would be a severe lack of hospitality for them to run out of wine. And so they go to Jesus, who of course makes the best wine that there could possibly be made. And they're like, good news, Jesus is in the house. Maybe he can do this for us. So there are these 10 maidens. They're supposed to be a part of a huge marriage party, but they don't know when they're going to be picked up for the party. Now, I've always found that part of the parable, he's just trying to make a point, right? You know, so he's not saying, by the way, at 10, I'm going to be showing up. Instead, you have this idea, and weddings back then obviously were a bit different. They came in stages. So the first would be, take my marriage, I would have gone, my parents and Wendy's parents would have kind of hooked up, talked about it, and there would have been, so to speak, a little bit of exchange of money, right? Now, at that point, she and I are contractually connected to each other, right then, at least back then, not now, right? Because to my knowledge, there wasn't an exchange of money behind closed doors or anything between our families, but I'll make that call this afternoon. So there would be an exchange of money, and that's a contract right there. We've come into an agreement with each other, our families with each other. However, we're not really married yet. We're just contractually connected then. At that point, they were kind of kicking the second part, which is I have to go and start getting the house ready for her. That means I need to start getting set up in my career. I need to make sure that I have a good revenue stream coming in. I literally have to go get the house ready. Now, she and I are technically at this point married, even though we're not living together. Does this make sense? So we're not living together, but technically we are married. She can't be dating somebody else. I can't be dating somebody else, right? That would lead up to the third part of an ancient Near Eastern wedding, which is everybody gets together for the party. She and I are actually married. We go away. We go back to that house that for however long it took me to get it ready, it's ready. And we go back to that and we cohabitate. And of course, we have children and off we go with the rest of the wonderful story. Well, Jesus is using that kind of an analogy, right? There's the promise that, hey, I'm returning. I'm coming back. And I'm going to get you. And I'm going to get you when the house and everything for your provision is set and it's ready. Now, here's the key. The maidens in the story, there are 10 of them. 5 of them do pretty well. 5 of them not so well. 5 of them are wise. There's this promise. I'm coming back for you. So they pack their bags. They keep their lamps filled with oil so that when he comes back, they're ready to go. By the way, we do the same thing. I keep my lamp filled with oil every week. The other 5, though, not so wise. They're going to do what they want to do, and they don't worry or think about the fact that the groom is coming back for them. So they're doing a lot of things, but they're unprepared for the wedding day. They're unprepared for the day when the groom comes back and says, now. They aren't ready. And so Jesus's point in the first parable is this: be ready. Be ready. Jesus is a man of his word. So when he says he's returning, he's going to return. Now, that leads to the second parable in Matthew chapter 25, and it's about a master. A master is going on a trip, and he leaves various amounts of money with 3 of his servants. He gives one of his servants 5 talents. He gives another of them 2 talents, and he gives another one of them 1 talent. I don't know why he gave 1 5, why he gave 1 2, or why he gave 1 1. I'm not exactly sure. What I know is that's what he did. And each talent, just so you know, this is basically like a measure of cash, right? And so he says, I'm going to give you talents. Now, 1 talent would be worth somewhere in a range of about $15,000. So Jesus wasn't giving like, all right, here's a $5 bill. I'm going away. He's giving 15 grand per talent. So he's giving a substantial amount. And he's also entrusting this to them. Now, the first 2 invest the money and they get a return on their investment, no doubt because they work with Edward Jones. Now, the third, just so you know, was afraid that he was going to lose it. And so what does he do? I was thinking about that. You remember the show back in the day, Cheers? There was this one character named Woody Boyd. You remember Woody, for those of you that saw it? Woody, by the way, he didn't have a bank account. He works at Cheers all these years. Never has a bank account. Instead, he stuffs money in his sock. That's where he keeps it. That's this guy. He basically stuffs money in a sock. So he's afraid he's going to lose it, and he buries it. Then, here's the thing. The master returns. And what does he do? He rewards the 2, those that made the investment. I've entrusted this to you to do something with it. He rewards the 2, but the one that buried his talent, Jesus actually described him in a very specific way. He said, you are wicked. You are wicked. Now, we have this picture of Jesus, that Jesus is gentle and mild, right? Jesus is always this picture of love and understanding. In fact, Jesus just wants you to have whatever you want for your own life. He's just here to make that happen. I don't get that by reading Matthew 25. I don't get that. Instead, Jesus wants you to get the life that he created you for. And so when he looks at somebody that says, I entrusted a task to you and you didn't do it, he actually describes them with the word that we try to avoid with labeling people. He says, what you have done and what you've become is wicked. Man, he just cuts right to the chase. So what's the point? In the first parable, it was be ready. In the second parable, being ready is using what God has given you for his kingdom, with the awareness, and this is the thing, that Jesus is going to be judging how we use what he's entrusted to us. It's already in the story in Matthew chapter 25. He looks at the two that made the investment and got the return, and he says, well done. For the one that buried it, what did he say? Wicked, or wickedly done. He's judging people. He's judging people for the choices that they've made with what he has entrusted to them. So part of what we get in Matthew 25 already is that we have to get over this idea that all I have to do, all that Jesus wants for me, think about the day. I came to Jesus when I was 11 years old. And part of what Jesus is wanting us to get over in Matthew chapter 25 is, hey, I just want you to ask for the forgiveness of sins and then get right on back to what it was that you were doing beforehand. I want you to get right back to what it was that caused the problem to begin with, which was just doing your life your way. Jesus says, no, when you cast yourself on me, you're saying I'm literally walking a new way. And so he's pulling these people apart in these judgments that he's making, which leads, by the way, to the third parable that we're focusing on for this morning. The third parable explains what Jesus means when someone is rightly called a Christian. And let me just say this on the front end, because Jesus is going to say some things that might really capture your attention. Because for some people that think that they're Christians, Jesus is saying, no, you're not. You're not. So just because you identify as something, Jesus is saying, that doesn't mean you are. I could identify as a lot of things if I wanted to. Doesn't mean that that's what I am. And this is where I want to pick up at Matthew 25, verse 31 to 46. Here's what Jesus says. It says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another, just as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right, which of course we know that's a figure of speech. It's a place of honor and privilege. He'll put the sheep on his right. He'll put the goats on the left. Now, by the way, if the right is honor and privilege, then the left is not honor and privilege, right? And then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you took care of me. Which, by the way, based on the coughing and everything happening today, you probably like that verse. I was in prison, you visited me. And then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? They actually seem a little bit surprised, don't they? Oh, when did we do that? Jesus, I don't remember directly giving you water or bread. When did we see you a stranger and take you in or without clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer them, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. And then he will say to those on the left, different message, by the way, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. Did Jesus just get right to it or what? For I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty. You gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger. You didn't take me in. I was naked. You didn't clothe me. Sick and in prison. You didn't take care of me. Then they too will answer. And they're surprised too, by the way. Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or without clothes or sick or in prison or not help you? And then he will answer them, truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. And they will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Jesus is separating things out. Did you catch that yet? He is separating things out. See, this is a tough message. You can see why it fails the Barna test. 40% of Americans want to walk away and feel, they want to feel encouraged. And then Jesus drops Matthew 25 on people. And you're like, I don't feel encouraged. What's going on? I mean, who is Jesus, even in this parable, who is Jesus talking about? he talks about the poor. Is he talking about like all of the poor? Do I have a responsibility to literally feed all of the poor? Do I have a responsibility to feed some of the poor? Who is it? He actually gives you some indications in Matthew 25 as to who he is talking about. And it may not be who you think. The phrases, by the way, people that were hungry and sick and imprisoned, he describes them as brothers and sisters of mine. That's who he's talking about. Brothers and sisters of mine. The least of these that he talks about refer to his followers and to his disciples. People didn't like Christians. Still don't, largely. The largest persecuted group of people on the globe right now are Christians. It wasn't any different back then. It wasn't any different. So you who say that you're a Christian, you see Christians that are facing persecution from people and you're doing nothing to help them? They're persecuted because they're faithful to me, Jesus is saying, and you're doing nothing to help them? You can see that part of the persecution is people are taking their jobs from them and they have no way to eat because they don't have income and you do nothing to help them? You see that their homes are being taken away from them because of their faith and you're doing nothing to help them? Jesus, you can see what he's getting at. Why would I look at you and say, yeah, just by watching the way that you act, I would say that you're a Christian? He's saying, in fact, if I watch the way that you would act, I would come to the opposite conclusion, that you're really not. The phrase, the brothers and sisters of mine, the least of these, are referring to his disciples. So Jesus is talking about suffering Christians. And here's what he says. He says, when you do something kind to someone in need, he says, you know what? You're doing that to me. These are people that are suffering for my name's sake. You do something for them, you're doing something for me. By the way, the opposite is also true. When you neglect a person that is in need, he says, you know what? You did that to me too. You did that to me too. It's important because Jesus is asking a couple of questions in this passage that are really important because eternity, by the way, literally is on the line. Not my words, they're his words. Eternity is literally on the line. Dallas Willard, I love Dallas Willard. One of the things that he said, so I've given a reflection, not just on what it is that people say that they believe about Jesus, but what it is that they do with their beliefs about Jesus. And this is the conclusion that I've come, Dallas Willard, this is the conclusion that I've come to, is most people actually don't believe Jesus. Most people don't. Even those that say that they do, they actually don't. He said, and the key characteristic, he says, not unique to me. It's something that Jesus told me to be looking for to begin with. What is it that is coming out of them? What's that? So here's the first question that I want us to answer today based on what we're talking about. Who is going to heaven? It's an important question, not often talked about. Jesus seems to talk about it a lot. And the reason is because he wants us to be in a specific place. So why not talk about it? Just this last week, I was in a conversation with one of my skeptical friends. One of the things that encouraged me the most in my conversation with them was they said, you know what? I've never become upset with you for sharing with me what it is that you believe. And here's why. Is because you actually believe specific things about Jesus. You believe that Jesus was God and a man. You believe that Jesus died on the cross. You believe that sin is real. You believe that life doesn't stop at death and that life continues to go on after death. You believe all of those things. And because you believe those things, you've been willing to sit down and talk with me about it. And I said, that's exactly right. I said, because think about the opposite of it. Imagine that I actually believe that Jesus is God incarnate, that he dies on the cross, that sin is real, that the effect of sin is literally separation from God. And I know that. Let's also imagine that I don't ever sit down and have a conversation with you about that. What does that say about me? What does that say about me? Now, what I can't do, I can't share with everybody. Most people in the world will never know that I exist. But I can share with those to whom God has put right in front of me. And the reason that I do it is because of what my skeptical friend caught on to, is that I really believe this. I really do. And I want them to know Jesus as a result. Here's the thing, the question, who is going to heaven? Not everyone that thinks they're a Christian is going to heaven, because not everyone that thinks they're a Christian, Jesus has already said, is a Christian. Not everyone that thinks it actually is. Look back. Let me just talk you through the three parables here. Let's go back to the first one. All of the maidens think that they are in good standing with the bridegroom in the first parable. All of them. I'm coming back for you. Five of them get ready. Five of them don't. All 10 of them think it's all good. It's all good. And yet, in Matthew 25, verses 10 through 12, he told the five maidens that didn't prepare for him, he said, I don't know who you are. In the second parable, each of the servants, you remember I've given you talents to do something with this. Each of the servants thought that they were in good standing with the master. The third one's like, I'm gonna bury this thing and that will keep me in good standing with the master. But he called the third servant both lazy and evil. Jesus is pulling things apart. In the goats in the last parable, they are sent into an eternal fire. And by the way, did you catch? They're surprised. They're surprised. When did we do any of these things to you? Remember? They are surprised. But see what Jesus focuses on here. It's not that what we do saves us. Let me be clear about that. It's that if we are really a follower of Jesus, you will be changed from the heart to the head, to your values, to your talent, with how you use your time and the way that you invest in people. It changes you when you've really encountered Jesus. When you've really encountered him, it changes you. That's what Jesus focuses on here. James does the same thing. In James chapter 2, verse 17, he says, faith without works is dead. James focuses on the same thing. Jesus isn't saying that we can be saved by giving to the poor. I want to be really clear here. He isn't saying that. He's saying one proof that we're not is that we are not showing any kindness to those who represent Jesus himself. That's what he's saying. So what does your mouth say? All right, question. Does your life fit your mouth? That's what Jesus is getting at. What does your mouth say? Does your life fit your mouth? I'm a follower of Jesus. Are you following Jesus? Simple question. And not all who say, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Jesus already said in the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, so I've given some thought. That seems like Jesus is really pulling things apart, doesn't it? Some of you that think that you're saved, you're not. And he wants you to take an honest look at your life so that you can get the right answer to the question. That's why he's doing it. So I gave another possibility here. Maybe these people are just lukewarm, right? I mean, maybe these are people that are just kind of middling, you know, they're flirting around with Christianity. That, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, yes. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, no. Sunday, I don't know. What's the week been like? Might get up, might not, right? Is it possible that lukewarm Christians are really what's being discussed here? I'm going to go ahead and give you the answer. Jesus is saying, no, that's not what it is. Because the whole idea of a lukewarm Christian really comes from Revelation chapter 3. And I want to unpack this just for a second, because you see this in Revelation 3, verse 15. Jesus, talking to the seven churches, and the church at Laodicea, let me just tell you what he says. He says, I know all the things you do, that you're neither hot nor cold. I wish that you were one or the other. But since you're like lukewarm water, neither hot nor cold, I'm going to spit you out of my mouth. You say, I'm rich, I have everything I want, I don't need a thing, and you don't realize that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. Does that sound familiar? When was I hungry? When was I naked? Does this sound familiar? You don't even recognize this, is what Jesus is saying. The image of the Laodiceans, this is the church that he's talking to here, being neither hot nor cold, has typically been understood as a metaphor of their lack of fervor. They just didn't lack fervor. I mean, it's there. These are people of faith, but man, they're just not that fired up about it, right? I mean, you think about going to you pick your favorite football team, right? And they score a touchdown, and everybody's just going ape, right? And you have this idea that Jesus is just talking about, you don't have that kind of fervor, and that's not really it. It's not really talking about just like, well, you got a half-hearted commitment to Jesus. One problem with this is that Jesus's desire that they be either cold or hot implies that those extremes are positive. Cold water is good. Hot water is good. And it brings up this question, why would Jesus prefer cold to lukewarm? Have you ever wondered that? I don't want you lukewarm. Be cold. Now, I know what you're thinking. On the one hand, you go, cold, that just seems like a no. right? Because what it sounds like Jesus is saying is, I would rather you be hostile to me, like just fully accept me or be hostile to me. But I don't think that's what he's saying. If we understand the term cold to mean hostility to the gospel, you have to conclude that Jesus would rather see a person as an antagonist or a hater of him rather than a half-hearted follower. It's just not what he's saying. It's doubtful. It's unlikely that he prefers hostility to half-heartedness because everything that Jesus has been saying before is I want you to know me. Why would he say, I want you to be hostile to me? It makes no sense. A better way to understand it is to think about what cold water and hot water actually are. Imagine that you live in Laodicea. This is a place that's like built up on a hill. It's fortified. It's fortified. They didn't lack for much, by the way, which is why Jesus says, you're rich, but your soul is sick. Your soul is sick. And here's what's worse. You don't even know it. It would be like having the coronavirus, but it hasn't manifested yet. You don't know it. You've gotten to the place, Jesus is saying, that you have deluded yourself into thinking that everything is okay. He says, so I would rather you be cold or hot. Cold, by the way, cold water, it refreshes you. You understand this. I grew up doing manual labor. Those were my jobs growing up in Northeast Texas. You know, I've been out in watermelon fields, sweet potato fields, worked on baseball fields. By the way, in the Texas heat, right? You get used to it, but I'm not going to lie to you. There were plenty of times where I'm like, it is time for some water, right? And you drink it. Why? Because it refreshes you. Hot water for them was used to heal. It was healing. Cold water refreshes. Hot water heals. Lukewarm water does nothing. It does nothing. History will help you out here. I want you to think about it. In spite of everything it had going for it, Laodicea lacked a good supply of water. Up on a hill, fortified, hard for enemies to beat, got money going around, don't have water. So what did they do? They actually built aqueducts that would pump water up to Laodicea so that the people there could have it. Otherwise, you couldn't be. In fact, later on, the city is abandoned because of a lack of water. Here's what one scholar said. For all its wealth, it could produce neither the healing power of hot water like its neighbor Hierapolis, nor the refreshing power of cold water like what was found at Colossae. But since the water had to be piped in, by the time that it got to Laodicea, it had traveled over miles. For miles it had traveled. It even had a bitter or chalky taste after traveling through the stone aqueduct. Remember, hot water is good, cold water is good. You have hot water is used for healing, cold water is used for refreshing, tepid water is useless. And the result that you see in this word to the church at Laodicea from Jesus was this. It says he spits them out of his mouth. Spits them out. Now, by the way, the word spit is probably not strong enough. Actually, it's not strong enough because the Greek word there is emeo, which means he literally vomits them out of his mouth. They make him vomit. They make him sick. Now, why does he use that example? Is because that is exactly what lukewarm water does. It would be almost toxic to your body to take it in. Toxic. And a lukewarm church makes Jesus vomit. It's basically a church filled with people that aren't Jesus followers. They're just churchgoers. There's nothing, and I want to say this, there is nothing mediocre about Jesus. Nothing. C.S. Lewis, one of my favorite thinkers, once said this, Christianity, if false, is of no importance, and if it's true, it is of infinite importance. The one thing that it cannot be is moderately important. And he's right. So what brought about this lukewarm living? I mean, what's the problem with these Christians? Jesus already said, they had the audacity to say, I'm rich, I've become wealthy, I have need of nothing. The case against Laodicea revolves around the idea of self-deception. You're sick and you don't even know it. It's like the young woman who went to her pastor and says this, Pastor, I have a sin and I want your help. I came to church every Sunday. I just can't help but thinking I'm the prettiest girl in the congregation. But this one's never happened to me, but you know, go with it, all right? I just can't help but thinking I'm the prettiest girl in the congregation. I know that I ought not think of this. I just can't help it. And I want you to help me beat this sin that's in my life. I mean, it's really setting me back from you. And the pastor said, hey, look, don't worry about it. In your case, it's not a sin. It's just a really big mistake. I do counseling on Mondays and Wednesdays. I'm kidding. I have this besetting sin. I want you to correct it, right? Francis Chan, some years ago, wrote a book called Crazy Love. I just want to talk you through some things that he said here. Because for some of you, sit there and you go, I'm a follower of Jesus. This morning, I'm going to ask something very simple. Are you? I mean, are you? It's the most important question that you could ask yourself. It is. And I can't answer it for you. Francis Chan, his book, Crazy Love, he says, I want to identify some ways that we can know that we are lukewarm. I mean, if that's something that we identify as a Christian and we're not, it's good to know, right? What are some of the things that he says? Let me just talk you through them. Lukewarm Christians don't really want to be saved from their sin. Lukewarm Christians don't really want to be saved from their sin. They only want to be saved from the penalty of their sin, but not from sin itself. You see the difference? I want to be saved from it. It means you have to deliver me from it. That means I don't do it anymore. It means I literally stop what I'm doing and I walk a completely different way of life. I don't want that. I just don't want hell. So can I have both? That's one characteristic. Here's another. Lukewarm Christians are moved by stories about people who do radical things for Christ, but they don't ever adventure to do radical things themselves. They call radical what Jesus expects of all of his followers. That's radical. It is different. It is different for sure. But a lukewarm Christian moved by the stories, but not enough to become a part of the story. Third, lukewarm Christians equate their partially sanitized lives with holiness. But Jesus didn't call us to just being sanitized. He called us to discipleship. If you're his follower, your life will not be defined only by avoiding sin, but you will actually enter into his suffering with him and see it as worth it. It's worth it. Lukewarm Christians rarely share their faith with their neighbors, coworkers, or friends. Lukewarm Christians rarely share their faith, if ever, with their neighbor, coworkers, or friends. Why? Just busy doing other things. Or just don't care. Lukewarm Christians think about life on earth much more than eternity and heaven. You already saw this in Revelation 3. You also already saw this in Matthew chapter 25. How much thought goes to heaven? Not much. How much thought goes to hell? Not much. How much thought goes to right now? Gobs. Gobs and gobs. Jesus wants us to live both in the hope of a future promise, but the impact that hope of that future promise is supposed to make in us right now. It's both. It's not one or the other. It's both. Lukewarm Christians love their luxuries and rarely give to the poor in a truly sacrificial way. Did Jesus just talk about that? Lukewarm Christians do not live by faith. Their lives are structured, here's the thing, so that they never have to. I'm going to structure my life so that I have total control over it, so that I never actually have to live by faith in Jesus. David Platt, who wrote the book Radical, said, if you're not in a place where you feel desperate for the Spirit of God, then there's no way you are on the front line and on the front lines of the mission. When we are on the front lines, we feel desperately our need for God's help. And then last, lukewarm Christians give God their leftovers, not their first and their best. Notice Jesus actually had a word for people that are like that, and it wasn't the word that we use. I'll admit, I even thought about it this week. For some, the word that we would think is, man, they're just indifferent. Jesus gave a different word. Lukewarm Christians give God their leftovers, not their first and best. So stop calling, here's what Chan says, stop calling your busy, your complacency and your apathy a busy schedule. Stop calling it that. Stop calling your complacency toward Jesus and your apathy toward him, my bills, I got to get to my bills. Quit calling your complacency toward Jesus your forgetfulness and call it what it is, it's evil. It's evil. Jesus has already said it in Matthew 25. He said it again in Revelation chapter 3. He pulls these things apart. And again, going back to the Sermon on the Mount, what does he say? Not all who say, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Not all. So some of us, we walk under this delusion that we're a Christian, and Jesus has said, we need to wake up. We need to wake up. What have I called you to? He said, be a follower of me. Be a disciple of mine. And we still remember this in James. The demons believe. The demons believe. And they shudder. Jesus is looking for more. It's more. It is a faith that genuinely changes you. Changes you. So where are you? Where are you at in all of this? It's a heavy one. I told you that before I started. I would love to pass the Barna test this week, but then I looked at Jesus's, you know, I looked at his parables and I was like, ooh, we're going to fail it this week. But you know what? We need to. We need to. Where are you in this? Would anybody look at your life and confuse you for being a follower of Jesus? Would that happen today? The only way, can I say this? And I had this from a word of a professor from mine from years ago. I didn't know. So when I was doing my doctorate at A&M, and I remember this conversation that we had. We were at a place on the campus, and I said, would you say that you believe that God exists? That was going to lead somewhere, by the way. Would you say that you believe that God exists? Here was his answer. His answer was, can I ask you a different question? Philosophy professors, you know. He says, can I ask you a question? And I said, sure. He said, by looking at my life, would you say that I believe in God? You get the question? Here's how he followed it up with me. And it goes right in line with what Jesus said before, by the way. He says, there are a lot of people that say that they believe something, but you would have no reason to think it. He said, I just want to go a different way and say, you've had the chance to be around me a long time. Would you actually think, just by watching me, that I really believe that God exists? Interesting question, isn't it? And so I had to tell him. Actually, yes, I was asking the question just so that I would know, get it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Jesus is separating us out. Jesus will separate us out. He says there are two possibilities here, not three. Two. There's the sheep. And there are the goats. The question this morning is, which are you? And I want us to spend just a little bit of time because we have, it's not just that I'm here, friends, it's that we have deacons that are here, we have staff that is here. We have Stephen ministers that are here. We are here to help. For some of you, you're just in a really difficult season of life. You know what? We want to help with that as well. It's not that you're sitting here saying, I don't love Jesus. You love Jesus. You're just in a difficult season of life. We believe in walking alongside you. That's why we have Stephen ministers here. In fact, that's why we have deacons here. If you're a deacon at Woodridge, would you just please stand up for a second? Please stand up. Now, friends, I just want you to look around for a second, because what a deacon actually is a person that helps me to meet your physical and spiritual needs. That is why they are here. These are people that are happy to pray with you, to encourage you, to support you, to do life alongside you. That's why they're here. And so in a moment, you know, we're going to be dismissing here in just a little bit, but you have an opportunity. You have an opportunity to go someone, whether it's one of these deacons or one of our staff, and to say, I just need somebody to listen to me for a while and to pray with me. And here's why, is because the things that we're talking about this morning have eternal consequences. They have eternal consequences. What we want you to know is we want you to know Jesus. That's what we want you to know.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.